Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate how everything, and I mean simply everything, even the most unexpected of subjects, has a history. Like
patches, pots and pitches, potion potatoes. Yes, it's everything to do with the letter P. Or oranges, orangutans, oddities, awful offers, odoriferousness, and olives. Yep, you've guessed it, everything to do with the letter
O.
O, thank you, Sam.
Interesting. I didn't know letters of the alphabet had histories, but of course.
Oh, we could do alphabets.
Oh, I'd love to do alphabets.
Let's do that. We'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, that the history of mothers, hello, Mum, it's your birthday this weekend. Happy birthday.
We've just had Mother's Day as well.
We have. It's all about medals, hair pulling, and Nazi Germany. Although the history of relics is in fact all about mountains, fraudulence, and the history of long walks.
Oh, and lying. Relics is brilliant. We're going to do relics, aren't we, soon?
We are. Love relics.
The man sitting opposite me is the Alexander Graham Bell of the historical telephone. It's Professor James
brilliant.
Daybell. Hello,
brilliant.
James.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Sam. And the man sitting opposite me is the Raj of the Record Office.
That's <It's> great.
The truly wonderful historical adventurer of fame, of note,
thank you,
Dr. Sam Willis.
Each week we kind of come up with a plan and try and talk through it. And last week we had so much fun talking about shrinking that we're going to carry on talking about shrinking.
We spent the whole time talking about miniatures, which I was not prepared for one bit.
No, but it was worthwhile doing. Tudor, so we spent the whole time talking about Tudor miniature portraits. And so just to recap, the Tudors became very good at embracing the tiny in life. And they did all these wonderfully, wonderfully small, very intricate, fabulous little portraits. So if you want to listen to that.
That were all over the place. Oh, we talked about Drake's jewel. We talked about the phoenix imagery for Elizabeth I, which is all about virginity, rebirth, flames.
And we talked about the using them as a source for other things. So what is depicted on them helps us understand things. So there's the African bust in the Drake jewel. There's the melancholy man we talked about, and with all of the buildings behind him and all the clothes he was wearing and his gloves and his hat.
The procession of Elizabeth. We talked about how these were private items. So often sentimental, very intimate. What we didn't talk about, which I was going to talk about, was shrunken heads.
Yes!
I had one of my favourite museums in the whole wide world. This is what a museum should be like, all you modern, newfangled places. Museums, I love them. But the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford is amazing.
It's a collection of craziness.
It's a collection of craziness. It's an authentic 19th century anthropological museum come natural history museum. Yeah. I think it's better than the Natural History Museum in London, though I love it.
Yeah.
Because it's smaller and you can get up pretty close. And they haven't sort of Disneyfied it in the way that they have the dinosaur exhibit. So you have the skeletons there. I mean, they're probably all fakes.
Yeah.
But I had a recent trip, took my daughters there, and it's full of all sorts of things, including fleas. And we're going to do something on the history of the flea, including tiny little fleas dressed up in outfits of clothes.
Yep.
But one of the highlights and what it's known for is its collection of shrunken heads.
What is a shrunken head?
A shrunken head, would you like to know how to... I will tell you. A shrunken head is basically you chop somebody's head off and you shrink it. So
with magic.
No. If you want to know, so it is a. I can think about it in all sorts of different ways. So the drunken heads that they have are from Amazonian tribes that collected during the late 19th, early 20th century. And these tribes would collect the heads of their enemies.
Yeah.
So once they'd attacked them, killed them, they'd take it off.
Yeah.
And by possessing the head, you would basically possess the soul and power of that person. And you would stop any kind of vendetta.
Yeah.
Do you want to know how to shrink a head? Okay. So... if you shrink a head.
But these shrunken heads, they're actual human heads.
They are actual human
heads. They're not pretend heads. They are not, they're pretend not animal heads. They are people's heads.
They are proper. So this is about.
They're kind of the size of a grapefruit.
Yes, yes. I mean, yes, absolutely. And people have been decapitating and shrinking heads for a long time, even in our sceptred isle. You think about the Tower of London and Traitor's Gate and heads put on that. So how to shrink a head? First, you kill someone. Hopefully you kill someone.
This is a great list.
You decapitate them.
Yeah.
You remove the skull from the head. You make an incision in the back of the neck and you remove the flesh. You then put seeds under the eyes. You sew the lips shut. And then you take away the fat. And then you put a wooden ball inside the head, like a sort of wooden shape, round shape inside the head, so that it basically keeps its shape.
Like a papier-mâché balloon.
Because you are then going to boil it. Well. So you need all of these features. You then boil it for a period of time, and then you dry the head with hot rocks.
Okay.
And at that point you shape it.
Okay, so it's heat. It's a heat-based shrinking.
Yes, and you would wear it around your neck on special occasions, and there are various sort of festivals and rituals where tribesmen who had killed the person would have this, and if you wore it over a period of time, it was thought that the power of the dead person would pass to his killers. And we see it through, you know, it was practiced throughout the 19th century. And you can, in fact, buy them today.
You can buy real shrunken heads.
You can buy them online. I was just doing a little bit of scooting around the internet.
That must be illegal.
There we are.
Shut up.
Yes.
Oh, my God, look at these.
So there are all sorts. The thing is that people traded in these. And so in order to get a ready market for it, you either needed to go out and kill a load more people, or you use monkey heads and goat heads and I imagine a lot of the heads on the market today.
So these guys are selling fake. I won't advertise where they're being sold, but they're selling genuine and legally acquired human shrunken heads.
How do you legally acquire a human shrunken head? I mean, obviously, if it's an artifact that is there, or, you know, if it's been done.
But how can you age it? You'll have to age it to prove that it wasn't done last Wednesday on some kind of unsuspecting person.
It's like body snatching, isn't it? The history of body snatching.
Yeah. I'm amazed by this. Real shrunken heads, RSH.
Isn't it great?
Oh, my God.
You need one. You said in the last episode that you wanted a raven. I think you should have a raven and a shrunken head in here.
Can I have a shrunken raven?
You have a shrunken raven head.
That would be really weird. Okay, but this raises the interesting question of how they got to the Pitt Rivers Museum.
Yes, anthropologists.
Right, so let's just think about that.
So 19th century anthropologist who toured the world picking up interesting artifacts, bringing them back. So they're people who are interested in indigenous cultures, and the museum is stuffed full of all sorts of things. It's part natural history museum, part brilliant anthropological collection. So it's full of pipes and pens and all sorts of things like that. I think the question so
people
is...
People travelling for knowledge, people travelling as missionaries.
These are people travelling for research. So they're Oxford-based anthropologists who are travelling for research. They're doing their research, visiting these communities, these tribes around the world, and they're bringing back their artifacts in order to put them on display, but also to study them.
Yeah.
And it becomes a sort of museum, an anthropological museum of that kind of that life. The big ethical issue is it right for museums today to have these kinds of objects that have been taken from indigenous peoples?
Yeah.
And so what you find is a lot of museums are in touch with the present day tribes. This is something you see with Native American artifacts all the time as well. You know, in that what you have is you have basically appropriated, taken an indigenous people's artifacts and culture. So there's a lot. The British Museum is sort of heavily into this. There's a lot of negotiation. Things are repatriated back to where they came from. But also often there is a pretty a good relationship between the museum and between different peoples. But it's an ongoing issue that museums have to deal with today. The kids loved it.
Bet they did. Yeah. So just while we were thinking about that, I reached over and I grabbed a book which sits by my desk all the time, and it is this book.
Moby Dick.
I have returned to Moby Dick several times in this podcast. I can't remember why, but I've decided that Herman Melville has basically been my inspiration for Histories of the Unexpected. Because,
really?
Well, he's written a book about the whale. And the book is full of the most amazing stuff that he's interested in. And
there's shrunken heads in that.
There's a shrunken head in it. Or there are several. No, there's a harpooner.
There's a harpooner.
Yeah, yeah.
Queequeg.
Tell me about Queequeg.
Queequeg is the cannibal harpooner who Ishmael, so the main character, meets. And on their first meeting, I think he's come back from a day of selling shrunken heads.
Has he?
At market, yes.
A day of selling... Wow, okay.
I was thinking about how that works in the novel, you know, and it's obviously the kind of, you know, it obviously adds a sort of certain element to the book that you've got this sort of slightly dangerous sort of cannibal character.
Oh, I've just found it.
In the book.
Were you going to read this out?
No. Okay. No, I have nothing on it except I just remembered that.
Landlord. So the guy is there. He's trying to find a harpooner, and the landlord's been. I've just been telling you about a harpooner who arrived from the South Seas, and he bought up a lot of embalmed New Zealand heads. Great couriers, you know, and he sold on them but one. And that one he's trying to sell tonight, because tomorrow's Sunday and it would be no good selling human heads about the streets when folks is going to churches. He wanted to last Sunday, but I stopped him just as he was going out the door with four heads strung on a string for all the earth like a string of onions. How good's that?
I'm sure.
There you are. There's
Harry Potter. Harry Potter and the night bus. I think the driver of the night bus has a shrunken head.
Oh, well, like swinging from the mirror, like a taxi.
Yeah, yeah. voiced by Lenny Henry, I think.
So where have these shrunken heads in the Pit Rivers come from?
They've come from the Amazon.
It's the Amazon.
Northwest Amazonian rainforest.
So the Shuar
tribes of Ecuador and Peru.
Huh, okay.
That they've come from.
But this one is obviously to do with New Zealand or the Pacific Islanders as well. I wonder
I'm
where
sure
else.
These are practices.
Is it an Indian thing as well? Don't know. Need to find that out.
Yeah. I think it's a process that's happens. I mean, the examples that I've come across before are associated with Ecuador and Peru, so Latin American, South American countries, and their various sort of tribes. The Shuar, the Acuar, Huambisa, and the Aguaruna tribes.
Aguaruna, wow.
This is testing my linguistic dexterity here.
I've just found the description of Herman Melville's description. Ishmael describes Queequeg. It describes his face as of a dark purplish yellow colour. Sorry, just to recap, this is the harpooner who is a cannibal from the Pacific Islands who Ishmael recruits to be the harpooner on the ship to go and hunt down the whale. And when he first meets him, he describes him as having a face of a dark purplish-yellow colour. How can it be purple and yellow? It sounds bruised. Here and there, stuck over with large blackish-looking squares. Later on, he realises the marks are tattoos. Ah, we're going to do tattoos. There was no hair on his head, none to speak of at least, nothing but a small scalp knot twisted up on his forehead. His bald, purplish head now looked for all the world like a mildewed skull.
Ooh.
Upon disrobing, because they're sharing a room, Ishmael describes his body in this way. He says, he at last showed his chest and arms. As I live, these covered parts of him were checkered with the same squares. He seemed to have been in a 30 years war and just escaped from it with a sticker plaster shirt. Still more, his legs were marked as if a parcel of dark green frogs were running up the trunks of young palms. That's why Herman Melville is so good. You have no idea where he's going to go next.
Where are you going to go next after shrinking? Put you on the spot.
We are not shrinking, after shrunken heads.
After shrinking heads.
I was going to talk about this when we were doing our Tudor shrinking. So yes. I'm going to talk very briefly about something. I need to show you something.
Okay, show me.
Here, Sam reaches for the biggest book in the whole world.
Is this one of your books?
One of my books. One of my massive.
Oh, your
fighting ships.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah.
Is that a Viking?
Yeah, that's
Viking dragon head.
It is,
on the
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
Did we talk about that when we did our podcast on dragons?
Yes, I think we did. Okay, here we go.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Now, I would like you, it's going to be quite difficult because we have limited space.
Look at this. So, oh my gosh. So, what we
there
have
are two
here,
particular things. I want you, yeah, just describe the first
so
big one.
We
and
have
one.
A ship plan here.
Don't direct
so,
that.
We have a very, well, this is a manuscript page, sort of late 16th century, and we've got some, if I would have a ship by this place to be made, the witch should blah 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 blah. So it's basically instructions for making a ship. You've got the description of how to do it, I imagine, at the top, and then a diagram or plan of how to make a ship. And then so that's the main insert. Oh, we should take a picture of this.
Ooh, the bottom one's amazing. That bottom picture. So have a good look.
The
at
The tiny
that.
Little bottom picture is a. It is a wood-panelled room with a desk in front of it with green baize on it and what looks like a master shipwright with a large... Is that a compass he's holding?
It's like dividers.
Dividers.
Yeah.
And what looks like an apprentice, a series of measuring tools.
Yeah.
And in front of them, they are working on a plan of a ship.
So, for someone who's interested in desks and paper and an office, essentially.
Yes.
This would be right up your street.
Love it.
Actually,
it is right up my street.
Having said that, do you know what, Dable? I reckon that
what,
you
Willow?
Could write an article about that picture because only maritime historians have written it, and maritime historians don't think about things
ooh.
Like desks and social spaces
so you mean
and paper.
The materiality of writing, Sam.
That's exactly what That's I mean, James. Have you written any books on that?
Five.
Okay, look. The point about this is mid-16th century all starts. This is from a book called Fragments of Ancient Shipwrightry, which is preserved in the Pepys collection in Cambridge. One of the...
Magdalen College.
Magdalen College, thank you. So one of the things that the Tudors got very good at, as well as shrinking portraits, they learned how to shrink ships. Now, this might sound a bit bonkers, but bear with me. So previously, when ships were built, they were built at the site of construction. They weren't designed anywhere. Designed at the site of construction. It was a physical process. They had a kind of very rough thing called a rule of thumb, and it was all to do with very basic proportions. A lot of it was done by eye. And this meant that... It meant all sorts of things, actually. It meant it was almost impossible to replicate a ship because you can't build the same ship twice. Because,
right.
Unless you've got exactly the same person being there, but even then it's going to be slightly different. The Tudors started to understand the mathematics of ship design sufficiently well to design a three-dimensional enormous warship on a piece of paper. And that's really, really cool. Because it actually allows you to then, it takes this whole design process away from the shipyard into offices. And it means that you can then have frank and open discussions with people who are not necessarily at the location of building or who don't necessarily know very much about building. It basically starts to really professionalize and expand the whole world of ship design and construction. So this is, it's not the earliest, but it is one of the earliest paper manuals on how to design ships, and it's all to do with the mathematics of it. There are, if you look very closely on this, you can see there's a scale down one side.
Yes.
You can see there's areas for mathematics, there's areas for equations. That's another
goodness thing. What's the date of that?
That's about the same.
Same month, so circa
1586, just before the Armada. But look, top left. So here we've got a huge Tudor galleon, and underneath it is imposed the body of a fish. So although this is starting to get mathematical, at the same time they're drawing inspiration from nature. It's classically Tudor. It's kind of it's half scientific and half thought through and half hocus pocus nonsense.
Yeah.
So they've designed it in the shape of a fish because fish swim quickly.
Yes. Sort of aquadynamics. And what's interesting is somebody has also done their sums.
They've done the sums on it. So this collection is—it's a working document. It's an area for doing maths. Here he's multiplied 60 by 24, and then he's added on 120, and then he's added on 2,880, and he's left with 17,280, which means something, God knows what. So there you go. It's a working document. It's one of the most interesting historical documents I've ever seen. It's some of the paper is thin, some of the paper is thick. Some of it's like kind of pasteboard.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big sort of jumble of stuff altogether. Some of it's got drawings on. Some of it has just got scales on. Some of it's just got equations on and actually mathematical workings.
So it sounds like a miscellany.
It is.
So like different sheets tipped in. So you'd stick it in as a sort of composite volume.
That's right. And Samuel Pepys, when he was Secretary of the Navy, he got it and then he preserved it and he gave it the title. So it wasn't called Fragments of Ancient Ship Repository. That's the title invented by Pepys.
Right.
But anyway, it's...
So he's presumably collected it, and then bound it in as his collection.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Yeah, and this is the one example of the Tudors becoming very, very good at shrinking things, making things smaller.
Excellent. Huh. Dolls' houses.
Okay.
Is where I want to go next.
Nice.
My daughters have the most beautiful dolls' house that I bought them one Christmas. Full of... It's three stories. It's got all sorts of rooms in. But for a long time, dolls' houses were not merely toys. We think of them nowadays as sort of as toys, heirlooms that would be passed down from generation to generation. The Barbie industry got hold of them and sort of glammed them up.
Yep.
And made them sort of ostentatious with helicopter pants on the top and all sorts of things.
My wife's mum had a dolls' house, which she was going to give us when my daughter was born. And I remember it...
And hasn't?
No, it got complicated and it never happened. But the...
Lack of space.
The point is, I think, that for her, the passing down of the doll's house was more important than the playing of it. It didn't matter if B never played
with
it.
It's that standard kind of heirloom that would pass down a matrilineal line. So it would pass from mother to daughter.
Oh, we're doing mothers.
We're doing mothers very, very, very soon.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm looking forward to that one. Mothers and relics.
Yes, all very similar. Anyway, this is very similar.
But there was a time when these were not, I mean, they are heirlooms, but they were not toys. So these were sort of little miniature cabinets of curiosity.
Yeah.
So they were sort of replicas of proper houses. And we have the most wonderful collections around the world of them. The Victoria and Albert Museum, in their Museum of Childhood, and we've done childhood, has the most wonderful collection of antique and historic dolls' houses. Over Christmas, I saw The Miniaturist. Do you see The Miniaturist, which is a TV show based on the novel by Jessie Burton?
I've read her most recent one, which I loved, but I haven't read The Miniaturist.
The Miniaturist, the adaptation of this for the screen was amazing. A sort of slightly sort of spooky story, but it's based on a real life doll's house based in, which is held in Amsterdam in the Rijksmuseum there, which was associated with the Dutch woman Petronella Oortman. And I have a picture of it here for you. If you Google Petronella Oortman.
How do I spell Oortman?
My Dutch pronunciation is probably awful there. Nadine Ackerman, if you're listening to this, you should correct my pronunciation there. It's double O-R-T-M-A-N.
Okay, yeah.
And it is the most ornate doll's house you can imagine.
Whoa! Okay, so this is it here.
You're good at describing these things.
This is the one in the Rijksmuseum.
This is the one in the Rijksmuseum, yeah. This is going to go up on our website.
Wow! Right. This is
super bling.
It's a doll's house on legs to start with. It's got 8 legs. Yep. Which is important, I think, because it you need to have the doll's house at the height of a child.
Yes. So this would not be for a child. So this would be for an adult.
For an adult to appreciate. Yes. Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
Okay. Well, either way, it's not on the floor and it's got its own way of supporting itself. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 major rooms. On either side, there are smaller rooms in the middle. The rooms are all elaborately decorated with wallpaper and soft furnishings and hangings. One's got a mural, one's got a bed, but two of them have got beds. I can't quite see what that is, but they've got tiny chairs. The sort of the kitchen or the parlour is fantastic. It's got loads of...
With a sideboard with plates
in. Loads of plates. There's a clock. Is that a clock on the wall?
Yep. This cost a fortune. A fortune. An estimated 30,000 guilders, which is the equivalent of buying a house on a canal.
An actual house.
like a real house. So the craftsmanship that's gone into this is very similar to the portraiture that we were talking about, the miniatures that we were talking about in part one of Shrinking.
Yeah.
The skill that's gone into rendering this, absolutely phenomenal.
I love that. I love that. And so how popular was this whole business? I mean,
we're talking social elites. It's an expensive hobby, but enough family houses like this exist. I think this is different from the kind of sort of doll's house that would be in almost every child's, playroom or bedroom or whatever, as you might have nowadays. You know, the one thing that you buy a daughter. It's the equivalent of a fort or a castle, if we can gender things in that way. But it wouldn't be as common and prevalent as it is today. And the examples that survive, because you've got to think about this from a sort of museological point of view. So from the perspective of collecting, somewhere like the V&A, the Victoria and Albert Museum, collects, and the Rijksmuseum, they collect fine examples that are... that are representative of a craft, or in this case, absolutely exceptional.
Yeah.
So that's great. Have you got anything more?
We've kind of run out of time a bit, but I was going to at least draw people's attention that a really important history, part of the history of Shrinking, is the history of shrinking cities.
Ooh.
So here we're going to take this idea of the doll's house and kind of increase it. I'm not talking... Oh, we could have done model cities. We could have done those...
Yes, Model Europe.
Yes. Oh, I love those. And let's come back and do Shrinking 3. Not called the panoramas. What are they called? When you go to museums and you see.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. There's one in Exeter, in the Ram Museum.
Yeah.
There's one little tiny museum.
Well, we should definitely do dioramas. I'm always fascinated by those. There are some wonderful ones in Chatham Dockyards, so 18th century naval dockyards. We know an enormous amount about them because. These fabulous dioramas exist.
I know almost nothing about them.
No, but
so I will be intrigued for you to teach me.
But I'm not actually talking about that now. I just want to very briefly highlight this phenomenon of cities becoming smaller, shrinking cities. And just a handful of examples. Most famously is Detroit.
Really?
Yeah. So Mona's Motor City.
Yes.
The economy collapses.
Yep.
It was also actually making steel. It's weirdly also with Pearl Harbor as well. There's an explosion and stuff with the Second World War. They start making things. Loads of people arrive. The city booms. Then it starts to collapse. And that's to do with the recovery of Europe and Japan after the Second World War. And then Motown itself just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And now it's a crazy wasteland. Have you been to Detroit?
I have been to Detroit. Yeah, I used to live very near to Detroit in Michigan. I taught in Michigan for 3 years.
Was that Ann Arbor?
Ann Arbor is just close to Detroit now. I was in the middle of the hand.
Okay. Anyway, so there are also the New Orleans is another one. That's a city which started shrinking before Hurricane Katrina in 2005, but then has carried on shrinking after it when 80% of the city flooded. Leipzig is another brilliant example, and that was because of the Berlin Wall. So it was on the eastern side, the Soviet side. Yep. And production stops, and there's a kind of a massive economic fallout in Leipzig. So there are these different parts of the world where
it's kind of reverse urbanisation.
It's reverse urbanisation, and it's absolutely fascinating. And people are still kind of, they don't understand
shrinking
it.
Cities.
They don't know why it happens necessarily. They know there are kind of all sorts of things going on around it, whether it's the Great Depression, whether it's the Second World War, but some cities shrink and they start to disappear. How creepy is that?
Very creepy.
Yeah.
What we don't have time for as well is micro-writing, which I've talked about a little bit. And, you know, there's a lot of work that's been done about 16th, 17th century spies and making secret letters really, really tiny that could be, you know, tucked up a sleeve or sort of popped in an egg or tucked in your collar. If you want to see an example of this... we've talked about Nadine Ackerman's videos, Vimeos, before. She has a beautiful video of how to do a tiny spy letter. And it's a spy letter from the Dutch secretary, Constantijn Huygens, to Amelia von Solms, who was the princess consort of Orange. And he writes a letter to her detailing, you know, what's going on with her husband and the movements of the army in 1635 in the Netherlands, the Low Countries, and it is sort of surreptitiously sort of sent to her. She then reads it quickly and tucks it into her sleeve. If you're interested in how this kind of thing would be written, Nadine's video shows brilliantly how that works. And there's an elaborate history of micro writing.
How would we find that video?
We would find it Google letter locking. On Vimeo, Nadine Ackerman letter locking, a tiny spy letter. I don't have the website here.
That's right, we'll be able to find it that way.
Yeah.
Listen, everyone, thank you very much for listening to part two of our shrinking podcast. I've really, really enjoyed doing this.
I thought this was good.
It was good, and I think there's more to be done because we mentioned tiny fleas and we mentioned dioramas, so we could do more miniaturization and more miniature writing. Please leave us a review if you've enjoyed it and tell everyone you know. We're trying to spread the word. We've got some live shows coming up. We've got a book coming up. We've got a big new website, which if it isn't launched yet, it will be very soon. historiesoftheunexpected.com.
Very original. And we are also on Twitter. You can follow Sam at Dr. Sam Willis. You can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow the podcast on at Unexpected Pod. We are enormously proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit and other great shows.
That's it. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.